Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Whispers in the Tall Grass by Nick Brockhausen. Narrated by George Spelvin. I'd like to have two armies, one with lovely guns, tanks, little soldiers, staffs, with distinguished and doddering generals and dear little regimental officers concerned over their generals' bowel movements or their colonels' piles. An army to be shown for a modest fee at every fairground in the country. The other would be the real army, composed entirely of young enthusiasts in camouflage uniforms who would not be put on display, but from whom impossible efforts would be demanded, and to whom all sorts of tricks would be taught. That is the army in which I should like to fight. Jean Lartigue, Jean-Pierre Lucien Osti, The Centurions. The Presidential Unit Citation, Army, for Extraordinary Heroism to the Studies and Observations Group, United States Military Assistance Command, Vietnam. The Studies and Observations Group is cited for extraordinary heroism, great combat achievement, and unwavering fidelity while executing unheralded top-secret missions deep behind enemy lines across Southeast Asia, incorporating volunteers from all branches of the armed forces, and especially U.S. Army Special Forces, Special Operations Group's ground, air, and sea units fought officially denied actions which contributed immeasurably to the American war effort in Vietnam. Military Assistance Command, Vietnam's Special Operations Group reconnaissance teams, composed of Special Forces soldiers and indigenous personnel, penetrated the enemy's most dangerous redoubts in the jungled Laotian wilderness and the sanctuaries of eastern Cambodia. Pursued by human trackers and even bloodhounds, these small teams outmaneuvered, outfought, and outran their numerically superior foe to uncover key enemy facilities, rescue downed pilots, plant wiretaps, mines, and electronic sensors, capture valuable enemy prisoners, ambush convoys, discover and assess targets for B-52 strikes, and inflict casualties all out of proportion to their own losses. When enemy countermeasures became dangerously effective, Special Operations Group operators innovated their own counters, from high-altitude parachuting and unusual explosive devices to tactics as old as the French and Indian War. Fighting along their Montagnard, Chinese Nung, Cambodian, and Vietnamese allies, Special Forces-led hatchet force companies and platoons staged daring raids against key enemy facilities in Laos and Cambodia, overran major munitions and supply stockpiles, and blocked enemy highways to choke off the flow of supplies to South Vietnam. Special Operations Group's cross-border operations proved an effective economy of force, compelling the North Vietnamese Army to divert 50,000 soldiers to rear area security duties far from the battlefields of South Vietnam. Supporting these hazardous missions were Special Operations Group's own United States and South Vietnamese Air Force transport and helicopter squadrons, along with U.S. Air Force forward air controllers and helicopter units of the U.S. Army and U.S. Marine Corps. These courageous aviators often flew through heavy fire to extract Special Operations Group operators from seemingly hopeless situations, saving lives by selflessly risking their own. Special Operations Group's Vietnamese Naval Surface Forces, instructed and advised by U.S. Navy SEALs, boldly raided North Vietnam's coast and won surface victories against the North Vietnamese Navy, while indigenous agent teams penetrated the very heartland of North Vietnam. Despite casualties that sometimes became universal, Special Operations Group's operators never wavered, but fought throughout the war with the same flair, fidelity, and intrepidity that distinguished Special Operations Group from its beginning. The Studies and Observations Group's combat prowess, martial skills, and unacknowledged sacrifices saved many American lives, and provide a paragon for America's future Special Operations Forces. Author's Note: Whispers in the Tall Grass is a first-person record of the impressions of tumultuous times and events. It is not for those with delicate sensitivities, or those who are unfamiliar with military vernacular and the macabre sense of humor that helps to blunt the reality of life and death struggles. I started to write as a catharsis to rid myself of my demons while illuminating some of the history and valor of the individuals with whom I served. The view is not one derived from the lofty heights of evaluation of the combat reports, archives of official orders, or the military's vast trove of dry, tepid accounts of battles devoid of the suffering of the participants. It is my reflections as a participant and as an observer. It is harsh, profane, and littered with the rough humor of those of us that survived. It is not always written chronologically. For that, I apologize. There are other great books out there that fit those historical parameters. My challenge was to let you see what the daily war looked like when we were out there trying to survive it, both physically and mentally, and yet not make the book a continuous string of missions from which we didn't expect to return. All of us tended to get banged up on every mission. Sometimes we could only be on the ground for 20 minutes before we had to be removed or be annihilated. Sometimes it was the trip home that wasn't survived. We had incredible air support from brave pilots. The chopper pilots flew to get us, knowing not if, but when their helicopters would be shot up. Through writing Whispers, I have found a deeper appreciation of our great republic, the times, and the incredible resiliency we possess as a people. Vietnam was an era of great turmoil and dissension within our society. Yet tempered with an ethos of duty, honor, and country that shaped my generation. Those core values are with us today. We imparted them to our children, and they still surface wherever our progeny are put in the crucible of war. The greatest tragedy to befall any people is the loss of the spirit of we, that sharing of ideals and culture. My generation was witness to just such disintegration and where it can lead, as we watched a country tear itself apart through division. We came home to the rot that had started in ours. In conclusion, these are the tales of my youth, written nearly 40 years ago when my recollections were fairly fresh. The book was never intended to be literature, nor is it scholarly. Whispers in the Tall Grass is a tribute to the unit, its record of accomplishment, and to the gallant, quirky characters that exhibited raw courage and dedication to the missions and each other under fire. Those characters and events will always remain vivid in my memory. Prologue. Whispers in the Tall Grass is the second book detailing my recollections of events and people that served with me in Military Assistance Command Vietnam Studies and Observations Group, MACVSOG, Command and Control North, CCN. CCN was the progeny of Delta, Command and Control Central, CCS, was the progeny of Omega, and Sigma begat Command and Control South. Our task at CCN was deep penetration reconnaissance in the enemy's hinterland and within his forward battle area. We followed the orders given to us through the chain of command in Saigon, under direction from the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the crowd over at Langley, Virginia. We reported ground activity of the enemy, wherever directed. As a responsibility and tribute to each other, we retrieved our own when a mission did not go well. We pulled as many of these bright light missions as we did the reconnaissance inserts. The book starts where the first book, We Few, left off. I have been with my teammates Mac and Cook long enough that we have become one animal in regard to our ability to survive and complete the missions assigned to us. Mac is a product of Alabama with a wealth of combat knowledge and is the leader of our team, Recon Team Habu. Both Cook and I outrank him, but he is the leader, our 1-0 by virtue of experience. Cook is also from the South and has a prior combat tour. In addition, he has attended Ranger School along the way, and we constantly tease him about his Rangerness. He is fondly tagged as Commando Head. Cook is our 1-2, and I am the 1-1. We as a unit, in reality, are everything that the Rangers want to be and more, but the tag fits Cook like a layer of military paint. Habu operates out of Da Nang, at a base called Marble Mountain. This is our garrison and logistics point, but we also use forward operating bases called launch sites, where we marry up with the air assets and launch our missions. The teams normally run with two Americans and six Montagnard soldiers, who we affectionately call Yards, or Little People, from the tribal areas, as well as the Chinese Nungs and some Vietnamese. Usually, the individual teams will be all from one tribe. They are drawn from the indigenous people of the individual hill tribes. They are battle-hardened veterans with a warrior culture. We have teams that are Bru, Sidong, Rade, and other ethnic groups. All of the Americans are non-commissioned officers or officers, and our bond with each other is more of a brotherhood than a standard army structure. In the main, we are special forces, with few exceptions, and the unit is all voluntary. We are a prime example of peer pressure in that regard, as the missions are near impossible without luck, skill, and superior firepower, all of which need to be there on the same timeline. We are constantly surrounded by virtue of the fact that we operate in and amongst the enemy's forward troop concentrations. Ours is a strange peerage system, as all the SOG teams are true meritocracies. Whatever the rank of the most experienced man is, he is the team leader, so you might have a lieutenant or a captain subordinate to a junior sergeant. To the uninformed, we would seem to be much too casual in our relationship to our officers. But it is quite the opposite, as we embrace them as brothers and co-conspirators in our mutual survival. Military discipline hasn't degraded, as might seem to be the case by our sometimes antics. Instead, military discipline has been enhanced through our shared suffering. The system promotes the talented and keeps our attrition levels low enough that we think we have a chance to survive. The first is a sterling idea. The second is an illusion. We are bonded by our trust in each other and tempered by having survived on numerous occasions near extinction as a cohesive fighting force. The team is everything. We are a family, and we are, by extension, Montagnard, or whatever ethnic group the little people stem from. More importantly, we are a major thorn in the side of the PAVN, People's Army of Vietnam. Our operations are tying up thousands of enemy troops in their efforts to thwart us. We cause far more damage to his battle formations and ability to wage war than conventional units. In order to contend with us, they have to use their radios and they have to deploy troops to encircle and destroy us, which creates a target-rich environment for the air assets. At the point where the book begins, I have survived to see the war and the missions get more difficult. The enemy has begun to use special anti-recon formations to hunt us when we are discovered in their territory. The missions are beginning to be one-way tickets for many, and our losses are mounting. We watch as the war becomes an open sore to the public and an unfinished task for us. As a functional combat intelligence unit, we are the top of the food chain. As NCOs and junior officers, we organize and conduct combat operations that in other circumstances would take much higher command structures and their staffs to replicate. With teams consisting of a few Americans leading Montagnards, we have intuitive, indigenous fighting teams that despise the NVA and are a true asset. Chapter 1. The Frying Pan. When the grass whispers, the lion stalks the land. Ashanti Proverb. The serenity of the South China Sea, splashed with the hues of the sunset, provides the backdrop to my musings. I am sitting on one of the bunkers on the side sea of our base in Da Nang, with a bucket of beers, occasionally lowering their body temperature with a CO2 fire extinguisher before popping one open. I wanted some privacy to sort out the demons in my head. We have been at this for nearly a year, and my thoughts are not on home or even surviving, but rather on my family here. The members of this cabal of the deranged, this pool of the homicidally talented, have become my brothers and, at this point, my kin. We have just returned from a much-deserved in-country R&R. During our absence, the bombing campaign has intensified up north. Due to the cookie's indiscretions, we are in double jeopardy. A soft rain starts to fall, and the air takes on that electrical excitement ahead of a storm coming from inland across the marshes south of Da Nang. It is pensive and yet charged, fitting my mood as I recall the past and steel myself to get back into harness. The past is just that. I try to put it all in perspective and prepare for the new beginning. The 2 yards manning the machine gun on top of the bunker begin to laugh and chatter away in brew about the camp dog, Ugmo. Ugmo is a cross between several breeds, including some Chinese breed that looks like a wrinkle factory and possibly another species or two. He is built like a midget mastiff and has an overactive libido. If it isn't mechanical, Ugmo tries to reproduce with it. I look over and see that he has chased down one of the camp ducks and has it pinned. He's trying to mate with it while the duck keeps pecking at his equipment in self-defense. The yards find it tremendously amusing and are calling out encouragement to the duck. I find it somehow philosophically relevant. We are the duck, and circumstance is a big ugly dog with its own agenda. After a tumultuous R&R, we are back at Marble Mountain, our home in Vietnam. It is also the home to 15 to 20 partial or whole recon teams, and everybody is acting like they know some dark secret that is yet to be revealed to me, a poor mortal. This would be the secret of what exactly was the social atrocity which the cookie had committed while on R&R in Saigon. Now we wait. My teammates are Mac, with nearly 18 months running recon, and our new guy, Cook, who had been with the team for nearly 5 months. A package of pent-up militarism that will someday do him well, that is, until this last sojourn in Saigon, where he had committed some horrible infraction that leaves us marked as social lepers. The team is under a dark cloud since those misdeeds appear to be worthy of excommunication and castration, just for a start. In the wisdom of the military, we all will pay for our collective sins against good order. We had earned this trip as we were due for one. Each year we are authorized one in-country and one out-of-country R&R, or as we called it, I&I, intoxication and intercourse. You would be lucky to get one R&R a year unless you were a Remington Raider in Saigon. Although in-country R&Rs were normally 3 days, we had wrangled an extra 3 days because of injuries sustained in a ruckus along the main hardball coming back to the camp from Da Nang the week before. Some deserters and other trash in a 3/4 ton had pulled up behind us, tried to pass, and when there wasn't room, they pulled back and fired an M79 grenade at our jeep. There never was a true escape from the war. Cook sustained broken ribs from where the shell hit the back of the seat he was sitting in. Luckily, it had not armed itself. Max sustained a sprained wrist and back. I escaped injury, but since the team was not able to run missions until we were healed up, I went along because I didn't want to strap hang with another team while we could be tearing up the rug in Saigon. I should have stayed back. We'd had almost a week away from running recon and bright light missions. Max stayed with Cook in Saigon, the first part of the R&R, but I had elected to go to Vung Tau, the old seaside French resort. I enjoyed a blissful 4 days of beach, alcohol, good food, and new acquaintances, before Max showed up to tell me that we needed to get back to Da Nang and we would pick up the cookie en route. On the last day in Vung Tau, relaxing at a cafe, I witnessed a bombing. After the dust dissipated, I had lost one of my new friends, and another was now without her legs. I was ready to go back up north where you knew where the threat would come from, and were prepared for the carnage. As planned, Mac and I retrieved Cookie on our way back from Vung Tau. Cookie had hung around in Saigon with Rocky the Ranger. Rocky is another Special Forces type who is assigned to an A camp somewhere in the outback. A former Mobile Guerrilla or Mike Force alumnus, he is unsafe to be around, especially anywhere that involves explosives or a proliferation of folks that go by the book. When we get back to House 10, which is the Saigon Nerve Center and safe house for projects, both Cook and Rocky are already considered unhealthy to be around. They had caused enough trouble in Saigon that there was a regular dragnet in force trying to locate them for questioning and recriminations, followed by swift incarceration. The MPs in Saigon staked out House 10 and have already made two sweeps in an attempt to ferret them from their hidey hole. Both times their luck held, and they were able to escape the long arm of the law. The staff at House 10 now wants nothing to do with them, and, though hiding them from scrutiny, are tiring of the subterfuge. Rocky has now fled to wherever he is hiding out, no doubt with pleasant memories of the mayhem he caused. I am sure that he is safe, comfortably tucked into some remote outpost of the exiled. He and the rest of his A-team are probably so far out in the boonies they are grateful to be surrounded by the NVA just for the company. We no sooner are reunited with the cookie than we are quickly bundled out the door of House 10, bag and baggage. We are taken to the airfield with the admonishment to wait 6 months before coming back. On the bird back to Da Nang, Mac and I listen to Cook's tastefully edited version of the sordid events. Even the air crew is studiously avoiding us. Evidently, they, too, have heard some hideous aspect that Cook is leaving out of our briefing, or they only know we have become persona non grata. I'm starting to feel socially syphilitic. Apparently, Rocky had slipped the bonds of common sense, so much so that even Cook was thinking of ditching him in Saigon. The warm glow of finding another ranger buddy to hang out with has dissipated. Cook and Rocky are both permanently barred from Mama Bix, our unofficial rest and recuperation headquarters downtown. That in itself is a record. I don't think anyone has ever done that before. The trip to Da Nang takes about 90 minutes, and the sound inside the bird limits the talking. I enjoy the time to think. As a group, Special Forces could exist as the mobile insane asylum for the Army. It is chock full of type A personalities with anger issues, ex-wives, and a predilection for violence. There also is a certain class of us that have been here for too long. These men have figured out how to manipulate the manpower shortages and the reluctance of the mentally balanced to jump into projects that involve signing a suicide pact as a procedure for acceptance. They move from project to project with no break other than a 30-day extension leave, and then strap on their gonads for another tour. If you show up at some A-Camp or the Mike Force or some other acronym, they are always glad to have fresh meat. By the time you have been reported as AWOL from the shipping depot, you are too valuable and essential to the mission to be released. Saigon will forgive almost any sin as long as you are willing to do the work. There are examples of the envelope if one wants to push it. Jerry Mad Dog Schreiber was a prime example. He was individually quirky, introverted, and deadly efficient in the bush. He was also burned out. He knew that his number was getting smaller and his chances of survival were almost nil. He wanted to quit, but he didn't. One day he went out as a strap hanger with one of the hatchet companies at Command and Control Central and never came back. He was last seen advancing on the enemy and is now officially listed as missing in action. Now he is a myth, a legend that haunts this war. The bush had just swallowed him up. I'm trying not to be like that. Once you take this war personally, you sever the bond that held you to following orders dispassionately. There is something fascinating about that, something akin to the moth in the flame. You have assumed a role that ensures your own destruction, but it flits around the edges of your conscience until it becomes more real than the thought of returning to a society that most of us have abandoned as surreal. I try to remember the faces and names of the 7 people that arrived here with me. Only 3 of us are still running missions. The rest are either dead or so badly wounded that they were sent to the States. I can't remember their names and only brief snatches of their faces. I can't think about quitting, though. It seems dishonorable. Not to the Army or even Special Forces, but to my peers here in this theater of the macabre. These are my brothers, my kin. My reverie is broken by our landing in Da Nang, where we will drive to our base at Marble Mountain. It is one of the particularly demented category who arrives to pick us up at the airbase in the form of the incredibly talented and emotionally twisted Captain Rob. As we make our way over to air operations, we spy Captain Rob motioning for us to get in his vehicle. We load our stuff in the back of his beat-up Land Rover, which looks like it barely survived World War II. No telling where he acquired it. There isn't a non-dented surface on it, and there are obvious bullet holes in the body as well. There is, however, the faint remnant of a USAID Hands Across the Sea emblem on one door. It looks like a wreck, but runs like a raped ape. Daiwee Rob may be wearing captain's bars, but I am sure that outside of his twisted peers in recon, the rest of the army wants nothing to do with him. He has been over here for 4 years already. He got his start in the Phoenix program, which was designed to eradicate the cellular structure of the Viet Cong. This was, in the main, accomplished by selective assassination. One normally conjures up a mental picture of assassins as Italian gentlemen in sharkskin suits, whereas the good captain looks like a New England schoolmaster, until you look into his eyes. He is also one of the few men I know that are perfectly comfortable with the thought that his or your existence is only momentary. He doesn't say much and keeps looking at us and chuckling to himself, as if he is in on some secret joke. Cook and I are sitting in the back seat with Mac up front with Captain Marbles. Rob keeps peeking at us in the rearview mirror and continues the chuckling. He turns out of the gate at Gunfighter, the sprawling airbase in Da Nang, and into the evening traffic. For sure, Cookie has committed some terrible act that he hasn't told us about yet, since no one wants to discuss the details. I'm not all that worried about any recriminations, since I have an excuse. I had escaped to Vung Tau before the horror story started. All in all, though, there is bound to be some sort of team counseling session. Mac was involved in part of it, but I can see that he is getting foggier about the details and is trying to distance himself from Cook. Rob listens to Mac and me laying the groundwork for Cook's plunge into the prime suspect slot. He looks in the rearview mirror at me and half sneers his first comment since he picked us up. "Did you guys kill someone?" The thought seems to amuse him, and he breaks out laughing. Mac and I look at him with the faces of two choir boys and answer almost in unison, "We didn't, Daiwee, but no telling what Cook may have done," making sure to emphasize his name. Rob just snickers into the wind. "It won't do you any good," he cautions. "He is your man." But then he sighs and adds, "At least you guys have each other." Now, there is an understatement. Rob has always been a loner. Even when he was running targets, he ran light, just him and four little people. When he was transferred to NKP, his little people quit to a man. They just walked out of the gate after discharge. If they couldn't run with our mad captain, then they wouldn't run at all. Joss, or Luck, as some would name it, is a river that we all swim in. I can't help it. I use his isolation as a means to get back on track. "You don't have anyone, Daiwee, because you are basically unlovable." He just snickers at that. He jerks the wheel, and we careen past a minibus with frightened faces peering out the mud-splattered windows at us. Mac looks at him and me before quipping, "Rumor has it, Daiwee, that your little people quit because you had taken to giving your weapon a woman's name." We both laugh at that until Cook chimes in from the back seat. "I give my grenades names sometimes." "What?" we both say in unison. He stares back as if it was a common thing and that we do it also. I make a note to check his gear when we get back to see if he has chalked something on his grenades, like some sort of weird bomb art from World War II. Mac just looks at me and makes the universal screw-loose motion with his finger next to his right ear. Rob downshifts and slides around the corner to the outer bunker line and the gate manned by the yards from security company. They rush out and remove the barrier, all the while grinning like baboons. The yards like Rob. To them, he is the ghost that walks. They treat him like he was one of their tribal elders. As we wait for the wire to be moved back, he wags a finger at us. Now that you guys are back, they have something special planned for the three of you. I hope that you are here.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?